When it comes to the U.S. Supreme Court, many women have been on the short list but failed to make it onto the highest bench in the land. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In the vernacular, it is called shortlisting. Of the 114 justices have made it onto the Supreme Court, only four have been women. There's a new book out entitled Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court, and is a work of two authors, award-winning scholars Renee Jefferson and Hannah Johnson. And on the phone this morning is Hannah Johnson, who is an associate professor of law at the California Western School of Law in San Diego. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you this morning.
So, what inspired you to write this book?
So the story of how this book began goes back about a decade. Renee and I were both colleagues at Michigan State University College of Law at the time. And it was about the time that Justices Sotomayor and Kagan were being selected for positions on the U.S. Supreme Court. President Obama had historically nominated two women to serve on the court. And in the context of those nominations, we noticed that the media was portraying these two highly qualified women in ways that were a little bit contrary to those qualifications. The media was focusing on things like the way they looked, the fact that they were single, they didn't have children. And Renee and I decided that since we were scholars, rather than just complain about this portrayal of women based on things that really made no difference as it related to their ability and experience to serve on the court, we decided to turn that into a research project. And so we set about the business with a team of research assistants and law students of reading about 4,000 articles that the New York Times and Washington Post had published about nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court going back to the early 1970s. And our goal in that project was to get a sense of really how nominees to the court, both men and women, were portrayed by the media. We suspected, and it borne out in our research, that women were treated a bit differently as it related to things like their appearance, their sexuality, their parenthood status. But embedded in that project, which could be the subject of a whole conversation, but not the one that we're here to have today, but embedded in that project, we found this gem of an article that had been published in 1971 by the New York Times about a woman we had never heard about. Her name was Mildred Lilly. Lilly was shortlisted for the U.S. Supreme Court by President Nixon. And in this article, the author focused on what Lilly looked like in a bathing suit. She maintained her bathing beauty figure, to quote the article directly. And it also was noted that it was fortunate that she had no children. After all, how could a woman with children be on the Supreme Court? We were shocked that as lawyers, law professors, we had never heard of Lilly's story. We always thought that the story of women on the court began with Justice O'Connor's appointment in 1981. But as it turns out, the article that we stumbled upon about Mildred Lilly opened up the door to this entire project, which has now manifested in the book Shortlisted. We wondered whether there were other women who we also had never heard of who may have been considered by presidents. And as it turns out, there's a collection of nine of them, ironically the number of seats on the U.S. Supreme Court, who dating back to the 1930s had been shortlisted for the court. So that's how the project began.
Let me ask you, before we get into Florence Allen, because I want to talk a lot about her, the attitudes by the male lawyers and justices early on, they seem, from the 21st century perspective, certainly strange. Tell me a little bit about that exclusiveness by these male lawyers and justices.
Absolutely. I think that women were not welcome. They certainly were not welcome at exclusive clubs where meetings, lunches, dinners often happened. And in many cases, they also were not welcome on the courts, where it was often thought that they would somehow sort of squash the sort of free flow of conversation that the male justices enjoyed and male judges enjoyed. And so there was a bit of resistance to the admission of women, not just into the profession, but certainly into the judiciary as well.
So the first one that you mentioned is Florence Allen. Tell me about her and the fact that she seemed to be one person who got considered by actually a number of people.
Absolutely. So when we first started the project, I should take a step back and say that we engaged in a lot of primary research. So we went through presidential archives. Many of the women actually have personal papers and collections. And so we pieced together this history by digging through that material. And initially, we came upon a list in President Roosevelt's archives that named Florence Allen as somebody who was being considered for a place on the Supreme Court. But through our research, actually realized that FDR was not, in fact, the first, but President Hoover appeared to have also considered her. Now, coming up with a list of who appears on a presidential shortlist is not as easy as it might sound. It's not like there's a Google form or something of that nature that presidents fill out. And so even piecing together who appeared on shortlists was a challenge. But yes, as you note, Florence Allen, who is a judge from the state of Ohio, was in fact the first. And her consideration for a position on the court dates back to the early 1930s, which is really quite remarkable in terms of a historical note.
In terms of the women that followed, is there a pattern of who was being considered, or did it just simply vary over who was perhaps prominent at the time? I know there were some who were federal judges when they were considered, others not. How do you assess that group of people who came then afterwards before O'Connor?
Sure. I mean, so Florence Allen was a first and a trailblazer in her own right. She ultimately held a position on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. So she was the first woman to occupy a position on a federal court in that way, and ultimately became chief of that court. But it did not follow 100% that every woman who was shortlisted for the court also even was a judge, although many were. I can't say that there were any real significant patterns other than all of the women who were shortlisted had impeccable backgrounds. They went to the top law schools. They had incredibly prominent legal careers as practicing lawyers, as judges. Even Carla Hills, who was the secretary of HUD. Really, their experience was wide and varied, but the common theme was that they were all incredibly qualified and would have made, by all indications, really excellent justices had they made their way onto the Supreme Court.
One of the interesting stories, actually, you tell is about William Rehnquist, who would ultimately, of course, become the Chief Justice, and Sandra Day O'Connor, and I think he was friends with someone else as well. Tell me about that story, because Rehnquist is known as a very conservative justice. He certainly moved the court to the right, and yet here he was with his connection with O'Connor and others.
Absolutely. They were friends in law school, and we learned from our research that at one point Rehnquist even proposed marriage to her. The history might look a little bit different if that had happened. But I think that the story of the friendship between Justice O'Connor and Justice Rehnquist reminds us, of a lot of things that we can cross political lines. Having supportive friends and partners is incredibly important. When I think about Rehnquist most recently, I had the opportunity to listen to Justice Ginsburg speak at an event in Washington, D.C. in the early part of 2020. And she talked about the impact that having women on the court had on justices like her friend and colleague, Justice Rehnquist. I think that having a varied number of perspectives on a court or on a board or in an institution really does change the game. And so even somebody who's quite conservative in that way, Justice Ginsburg spoke about the sort of the shift that she observed in many of his perspectives, really probably based on having these relationships with women and developing an understanding of some of the issues that affect people who are different from us. And that's really, I think, that kind of gets at the crux of why having more women on the court is so important. It's not that we promote a particular viewpoint. It doesn't mean that all of the justices have to be feminists. In fact, we think the court would be much better off if we had women with a range of perspectives and backgrounds and viewpoints, just as the court has been seated with men who represent a range of ideas and perspectives.
As a matter of fact, in terms of women of color, how many were considered in term before, obviously, I guess Sotomayor, I guess, she made it finally onto the Supreme Court?
So from our research, of the 9 women who were shortlisted before Justice O'Connor, there was only one woman of color. Her name is Amalia Kearse, and she was one of the first women of color on Wall Street, and she's a remarkable woman, although somebody, again, who probably has not really been talked about or heard of. We were a bit shocked that there was only one of our list of 9.
In terms of you're talking about the various political perspectives, and you do mention, as a matter of fact, there were a number of who were conservative. I think one woman who was being considered, some of her views about race, certainly Ray would have raised some eyebrows. How do you evaluate that? Because in the end, when we see the women on the Supreme Court today, we see basically on the feminist side of it, as it were, if one to make a judgment at all. Tell me a little bit about that variation.
So it's true that the women who are on the Supreme Court today represent more progressive or liberal viewpoints, although it's important to note that Justice Sotomayor was, in fact, initially appointed to the bench by a Republican president. A number of the women, not all, but a number of them, and Amalia Kearse would be among those, were actually considered for positions on the Supreme Court by presidents who represented both political parties. Both President Clinton and President Reagan considered her for the Supreme Court. And so I think that piece is certainly interesting, and I think we tend to get caught up today in this political polarization that is very characteristic of our contemporary political life and judicial life. But certainly, historically, I think that was less the case, at least as it relates to some of these women who were considered.
By the way, in the Republican Party, the thing that really struck me is that there was a real push in the Nixon era, the Ford era, particularly the women around those presidents to have a woman appointed onto the Supreme Court. Tell me a little bit about that. It seems almost an era now gone by.
Absolutely. I mean, President Reagan obviously gets an incredible amount of credit for really breaking with tradition and appointing Justice O'Connor to the court, although he does get that credit and really changed history by making that appointment. It's also true that when one looks closely at his record of judicial appointments, there were not that many women who actually followed. And in fact, our research uncovered a very interesting memo that was written in the White House by warning Reagan and his staff that if they didn't continue along this trajectory of appointing women, that there would be real problems and potentially a backlash. But at the end of the day, he really stopped short of pushing that agenda in the way that somebody like President Carter actually did. Now, Carter, of course, didn't have the opportunity to appoint a justice to the U.S. Supreme Court, but he certainly has had an incredible record of diversifying the judiciary up to, but just not including the Supreme Court.
As I understand, he had an entire structure put in place.
Yes, absolutely. He used an executive order to really use sort of a system to promote more women and minorities to the bench. And in the judicial nominating commissions that were created, made sure not just that those commissions looked at qualified women and minority judicial candidates, but also that those commissions were comprised of women and minorities themselves.
By the way, one I guess almost a footnote is reading your book about President Nixon. He didn't seem to think that women should be on the bench at all, even though he considered putting somebody on the bench, at least on a short list, because of the politics. I mean, his attitude seemed really strange.
Well, I mean, I think it's strange in some ways, but in other ways, it's, you know, certainly when you look at our political world, it's not a stretch that presidents and other politicians sometimes are calculated in the decisions that they make. And you're absolutely right. He was not that interested in having a woman on the court, but apparently thought that proposing somebody in that regard might buy him some support or some votes. But ultimately, and the woman that you're referring to is Mildred Lilly, who was a judge from California, and in fact, the woman who I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation really sparked the origins of this project. As it turns out, President Nixon put forth Lilly before the American Bar Association's Judicial Committee, and that committee ultimately deemed her to be unqualified for service on the U.S. Supreme Court, which it's difficult to think that there may have been some sexism at play. Although, you know, what it would have been like to be a fly in the wall of those deliberations would be fantastic, but none of us, of course, really know.
You mentioned that was sort of Nixon's out in terms of not having to appoint her, I guess.
Yes, absolutely.
By the way, I want to turn, by the way, to Harriet Myers, because I remember that appointment well. She was appointed by George W. Bush and then obviously withdrawn with a backlash. Tell me, describe for me, first of all, what her background was in comparison to other justices or judicial appointments, and two, what produced this kind of backlash?
So it's a really good question. From our perspective, Harriet Myers was just as qualified as other nominees to the court and probably should have been confirmed. She went to a great law school. She occupied leadership positions. She was a president of the Texas State Bar. She had basically been legal counsel to the president for years, not just when he was in the White House, but also when he was governor. But there were probably a few things that got in the way of her selection. And we do believe that many of the barriers to her ultimate nomination were grounded in explicit gender bias. So we use an example to illustrate this of Judge Bork, who, as you will recall, also never made it onto the Supreme Court. His nomination had failed. He had written an opinion piece basically critiquing her state bar presidency as meaningless, and if anything, more of a liability. And I contrast that with something that President Nixon said about Justice Powell, who ultimately was selected to the court. He heralded that that Powell had been the president of the American Bar Association. So in one context, it's a liability, and another, it is something that makes a possible contender even more qualified for the position. There was another, I think, thing worth noting about Harriet Myers, and that was that she didn't have a connection to the Federalist Society, who, at the time, their role was increasingly important in and influential in shaping nominees and appointments to the Supreme Court, particularly for, obviously, for conservative presidents.
We've been sort of referencing a little bit of this, but you talk about women being in a bind, that they it's sort of a no-win situation, whether they're married, not married, have kids, not kids. Describe that bind that women will find as they try to move up the ladder.
Sure. So we talk about the double bind as being confronted with a set of choices, neither of which really will generate the desired outcome. You know, as I noted when Justices Sotomayor and Kagan were being considered for the court, neither had children. And that was really picked up on as a negative, right? That there was somehow something strange about the fact that they were childless. In fact, several media headlines read like, "The Supreme Court needs more mothers." But on the flip side, women who are mothers face incredible scrutiny that we can't do both our professional job and our personal one. And what's interesting about that bind is that one of the women in our book, Susie Sharp, who was a chief justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court at the heyday of her career, she actually believed that bind. So in her mind, a woman could be either a judge, a lawyer, a professional, or she could be a mother, but she could not be both. And true to her belief, Sharp never married, never had children, and really prioritized her professional career over the more traditional roles as women, as a woman. But to your point about the double bind, these binds are difficult, they're challenging. We face them all the time, whether we're talking about what we're wearing, what we do, where we go to school, how we navigate our professional lives. So I think the example of Harriet Myers, who was criticized for meeting the Texas Bar Association, but somebody else, a man, was heralded for that accomplishment, illustrates how sometimes we just can't win.
By the way, I'm curious about the impact of the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas, and then Brett Kavanaugh, Blasey Ford controversies play into our image of women who move on to the Supreme Court. Obviously, neither the women were in contention, but certainly the men were. How do you see the stereotypes that you see playing out in those conflicts?
So that's a really, really good question. You asked me the question again.
Sure. That's up, no problem. So how do you see the kinds of images that we have of women being played out with, say, the controversy between Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas? Obviously, she complained of sexual harassment. And then, obviously, later on, we had Brett Kavanaugh and Blasey Ford, who, again, involved in this. Neither the women were up for the court, but, of course, certainly the two men were.
I think that both of those controversies really illustrate a problem that women in the professions face, and that is sexual harassment. And I think that those controversies also illustrate how women are often not believed. The impact of the sort of subsequent Me Too movement and the way that women who come forward and talk about sexual harassment and talk about their experiences, it again is reminiscent and maybe a little bit of a different take even on this double bind that we were just speaking about. So when somebody does come forward and complain about harassment, we see from this very public spectacle, I think it's an appropriate word to describe both Hill's testimony when Clarence Thomas was considered, as well as Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony in the Kavanaugh context, as a spectacle. We see how women are not believed. So our choice is to be quiet and just endure the harassment, or speak up and really, in the case of both of these women, become subject to lifelong scrutiny.
How do you see women on the court when it comes to issues like sexual harassment or gender discrimination? What kind of influence do you see them having on the courts?
So I think that question, it's a great question, and I think it could be answered in a couple of ways. There are a lot of scholars who study the impact of judicial decision-making. And I think that it's fair to characterize many of those studies as revealing that there really isn't a difference between the way that male judges and female judges render their opinions, except when we're talking about things like gender discrimination. But I think it's also important to talk about this in the context of just the influence that having women or people with different perspectives generally on a judicial body, and sometimes one's personal experience can really influence their coworkers, their peers, their fellow judges, and certainly we have we've heard a lot of discussion that has come out from Justice Ginsburg, I think most immediately, of how her male colleagues certainly don't always understand what it's like to be a woman. You might think or recall the case about the 13-year-old girl who was strip searched by her school for having ibuprofen on her person, which she had because, as many young girls do, when they have their period, they need to have pain relief. And Justice Ginsburg famously has spoken to the media and outside of the context of the judicial opinions and talked about how her male colleagues certainly couldn't possibly understand what it's like to be in the shoes of a 13-year-old girl going through something like that and then being subject to such humiliation. So I think that that example illustrates how sometimes just having diversity of gender, race, ethnicity can really help all of us understand what it's like to stand in the shoes of others and broaden our perspectives. If we ourselves have not been subject to the pervasive kind of sexual harassment or sexual violence, hearing from those who have can be quite compelling.
Finally, we've of course had Hillary Clinton, who ran for president of a major party. We also have seen a number of women who've run for president in the primary. Obviously, Joe Biden now looks like he's a presumptive nominee, but he's pledged to appoint, I believe, an African-American woman to the court. There seems to be a general trend. The Me Too movement is another example of something going on that may very well propel more women onto the courts.
Absolutely. I think that having more women in positions of leadership and power will open the door for appointments, for judicial appointments and other kinds of appointments. Certainly, I think of Sandra Day O'Connor and something that she said about the sort of the first step to obtaining power is about being visible. And so having women in leadership roles, whether it's on a presidential ticket as a president or a vice president, as one example, really, I think it has the potential for opening up those opportunities. I think back to my own background when I was in middle school. I'm dating myself here, but the Mondale presidential ticket, of course, included Geraldine Ferraro as the vice president. And as a young woman coming of age, it was incredibly powerful for me to see a woman in a role like that. And so I can't help but think what having, Hillary Clinton's unsuccessful bid for the presidency certainly put on the radar of so many people that such a thing is possible. Madeleine Albright famously talks about how it never occurred to her as a young woman that she could, in fact, be Secretary of State because she had never seen one in a skirt. And so to that point, I think having a woman as our vice president may likely result in further diversity of our judiciary.
Although you warned, there is a trap of tokenism, but we've run out of time here. We could go on and on. We've been speaking with Hannah Johnson. She is an associate professor of law at the California Western School of Law in San Diego. And the name of the book is Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. Appreciate you taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.